The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Bob Ford. I'm a sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and it's my honor to get to introduce our speaker this evening. I've covered six sets of Olympic Games for the Inquirer, and it's always an enjoyable and extremely challenging task. Enjoyable because it's an event of such great scope with so many great athletes, so many things going on all at once, and it's challenging for exactly the same reasons, because there's just so much going on at once. You often feel, as the games are going past you, that you're trying to grab the dandelions as they go past and just try to grab these great stories. David has grabbed a number of the great stories in this book and put them all together for us. If you had asked me which Olympics I would like to have seen him chronicle, it probably would not have been Rome, just off the top of my head. People, what comes to mind really are the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, the Hitler Olympics, the 1972 Olympics in Munich, the tragedy of the Palestinian athletes, or the Palestinian terrorists and the Israeli athletes, pardon me. The 1968 Olympics in Mexico City, the Black Power salute of Tommy Lee and John Carlos. The Rome Olympics, however, great writers find great stories, and that's what David has done. And often, as so often happens with writers, it's the story that chooses the writer, not the writer that chooses the story. He was researching one of his previous books on Roberto Clemente and the very important season of 1960 when the Pittsburgh Pirates went on and won the World Series against the New York Yankees. And as he was reading the sports sections, going through and looking at these stories about Clemente, he kept seeing these incredible stories on every page about the Rome 1960 Olympics, about young Cassius Clay, the boxer from the United States, about Rayford Johnson and Wilmer Rudolph. And he kept reading all the stories that put this into context. This was the first commercially televised Olympics. This was the first time there was any inkling that there was systematic drug use, performance-enhancing drugs in the Olympics. There was actually a death of a Danish cyclist during the 1960 Olympics. This was the coming of the equal rights movements, the very start of it in this country for blacks and for women. And that was all coming to a head at that same time. It was the very, very height of the Cold War, and there was a great deal of espionage, a great deal of intrigue in Rome in terms of trying to find defections on both sides. There was the great conflict between nationalist China, Red China, in which the nationalist Chinese were forced to compete under the flag of either Taiwan or Formosa. And when he kept seeing all of these stories and he put them all together, he knew that he had not just a book, but a book that could synthesize that time. David was very much born to be a journalist. He was very much born to put words on paper and to bring them to you. His grandfather was a printer. His father was a newspaper man. His mother was a book editor. His family settled in Madison, Wisconsin when he was 8 years old. And by the time he was a freshman at the University of Wisconsin, he was writing for the Madison Capital Times. And sort of presaging his twin interests, he was covering the radical anti-war movement on the University of Wisconsin campus and high school sports in the community. So he's a guy that can do a little bit of everything. After college, he did some radio work for a few years and then landed at the Trenton Times just up the road, just a couple years after the Times had been purchased by the Washington Post Company. And it didn't take the Post long to realize what they had. And David went to work for the Post in 1977, I believe I could have that date wrong, and went into their political reporting. He went on to their national desk. In 1992, he was given the assignment of covering the campaign of Arkansas Governor William Clinton, a guy who was not given a whole lot of chance in that election, as you recall. And David did pretty good on that assignment and covering the campaign and the election of Clinton. He was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting. It was the first of two Pulitzer Prizes. He has won at the Post. The other was just this year as part of the team coverage of the Virginia Tech shooting in 2007. He's also been a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize three other times, two times for his newspaper work and once for his fine narrative about the Vietnam War. They Marched in the Sunlight. This is his third book on sports, and for someone like me who works in sports all the time, to have people like him come along, they uplift our profession, they raise the playing field for the rest of us. He follows in a very long line of great writers who have gone over and done sports work, and you can name A.J. Liebling and Damon Runyon and Ernest Hemingway and Joyce Carol Oates and David Halberstam, and this guy fits right in with him. And please join me in welcoming to Philadelphia Night, great, great pleasure to have David Marinus with us.
Thank you, Bob. That was a not only flattering but a wonderful summary of the book. It saves me a lot of time. I'm on the fifth day of a 34-day book tour. It started at the in Chicago at the Chicago Council of Global Affairs, and sort of to understand the gamut of this book, it goes from there to Mike and the Mad Dog Sports Talk Radio in New York, or to a one of my favorite moments in Jock Talk Radio when I was at a station in Dallas, which I'm going to again, and it was two co-hosts, and one guy said to me, "Man, this is the best book I've ever read." It was the Lombardi book. And his co-host said, "Well, of course, dummy, it's the only book you've ever read." I had the pleasure of speaking here a few years ago for my book on Roberto Clemente. And it was really one of my favorite moments of that tour that I still tell the story, where in the book I was describing how Clemente, for all of his wonderful attributes, was not a saint by any means, and that at one point, in fact, outside of the stadium in Philadelphia, he had punched out a 19-year-old kid who was trying to get an autograph. Roberto thought he was trying to accost him, and he hit him in the face and knocked a couple of his teeth out. So I was telling that story to say that Clemente was human. And then after I finished, three people in the line as they were signing books said, "Well, Clemente was, of course, right. I mean, this guy was from Philadelphia, you know." So, as Bob said, I sort of backed into this book. I was researching Clemente and just saw those amazing names. But I really wasn't sure that I wanted to write another sports book at that time. Not that I, make that great of a distinction between sports and politics. I think, honestly, that politics can be trivial or important, and sports can be trivial or important. They both can be toy departments, or they can be very, very revealing about human nature, and that's what I look for in each of those themes. But in any case, I had just finished Clemente, and I wasn't thinking that I'd want to do another sports book, but it really was just hit me over the head, those names, Cassius Clay, Rafer Johnson, Wilma Rudolph, Abibi Bekele, and I couldn't get them out of my head. And I had remembered the 1960 Olympics. I'm 58 years old. I just turned 11 when those Olympics began in August of 1960. My profoundest memory, my only really vivid memory, has nothing to do with either any of those four. I do remember Cassius Clay a little bit. I remember Wilma Rudolph vividly. But the strongest memory I have is of the India-Pakistani field hockey match. And I was just an 11-year-old kid in Madison, Wisconsin, and the Pakistanis won by an upset, and their team gathered in a huddle after as they were about to get the gold medals. And they started jumping up and down and chanting, "Wahoo, wahoo, Pakistan, Pakistan." So here I'm, this little kid in Madison, Wisconsin, dancing around in my living room, "Wahoo, wahoo, Pakistan." I had no idea about Pakistan. I knew nothing about field hockey, but it just seemed like fun. And that really is my strongest memory of those Olympic Games. What sealed the deal for me in terms of writing this book, along with those great characters, I'm always looking for character, drama, and a way to illuminate history, sociology, and culture. And in those games, I truly found all of that. It's very true, when I first started telling people that I was writing a book about the Olympics, they would mention the three that Bob did, 1936, staged in Nazi Germany in Berlin, right? And you know, as World War II and the Holocaust were approaching, very, very important moment. And I write about some of that in this book because one of the key characters involved in that, in an ignominious way, Avery Brundage, the president of the International Olympic Committee in 1960, led the American Olympic Committee in 1936. I'll get back to that. 1968 with Tommy Smith and John Carlos and the Black Power salute. A very vivid, unforgettable moment etched in our histories, right in the turmoil and tumult of 1968, that unforgettable year. And then 1972, which we all remember so vividly with the tragedy of Munich and Jim McKay's coverage, who also is in this book. 1960 was his first Olympics. But 1960 to me has nothing, no individual moment quite like those three, but more moments. It brings all of it together. In 1960, you really see the ushering in of the modern world, for better or worse, in every possible way. This was at a moment of deep tension in the Cold War. Right before the Olympics began, Gary Powers, the pilot of a U-2 reconnaissance spy plane, which had been shot down over Soviet territory in May of 1960, only a week before the games began, he had been convicted of espionage in Moscow. Before the Olympics ended, Nikita Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union, sailed from the Baltic to New York for that famous moment at the United Nations where he pounded his fist and railed against the West. Some of you might think he pounded his shoe. He didn't. And the great biographers in the last 5 years have essentially documented that he did not. What's most fascinating about that is there's no videotape of it, so you can't, you know, it's all based on eyewitness reports. Anyway, he did pound his fist. And that was the tension between the Soviet Union and the United States at that time. But it was being played out throughout the world. In Africa, 14 countries were getting their independence that very summer. And such fertile territory in the propaganda war between East and West. Nobody knew which way many of those countries would go. Would they go with the Soviets or with America? And that had a resonance in the United States because of the civil rights movement in its early stages in 1960 and how that related to our foreign policy. In Europe, Germany was less than a year before the Berlin Wall. And there was intense questions about whether West Germany would get the bomb, whether the Soviets would try to invade. The U.S. Army was in force in Berlin. And in one of those Orwellian moments, as the Olympic Games were being played out, East Germany closed its border to Westerners. They wouldn't allow West Berliners into East Berlin during those games, as thousands of East Germans were attempting to flee. In Asia, it was going on at that time. The two Chinas dispute. This was only 13 years after Mao Zedong took over in mainland China and Chiang Kai-shek brought his government to the islands of Taiwan and Formosa. Chiang Kai-shek was trying to persuade Eisenhower still to invade the mainland. The presidential debates of that year between John Kennedy and Richard Nixon centered much of it on China and what the United States would do to defend the islands of Taiwan and Formosa. Questions about the little islands, some of you might remember, of Quemoy and Matsu, and whether if they were bombed by the mainland, what would the United States' response be. So all over the world, in Africa, Asia, Europe, and the United States, you could see all of those tensions. And they all came to bear on the Olympics. Rome was teeming with spies. There were attempts at defection. It was not just a battle of medal counts, but of lives and people as well. And as I was researching this book, I discovered one of the most amazing stories that had not been told was about the American sprinter David Sim, a medical student at Duke University, who was a sprinter. In the mid-50s, he was briefly considered the fastest man in the world. He was injured before the 56 games in Melbourne and then made a comeback and made the United States team in 1960. Sim was a very intelligent guy. He'd been on a State Department tour before. Washington knew him and knew of him. A few days before the track and field team left for Rome, he was approached by an American intelligence agent who said, "Can you come with me to Washington? We'd like to talk to you." They flew down to Washington. He went into a room. They took out a dossier of a Soviet long jumper named Igor Tarovinesyan and said, "This man, you know, is very westernized. He loves jazz. He's learning English. He was in Philadelphia in 1959 for the second ever dual track meet between the Soviets and the Americans. The first was in Moscow in 1958. The second was right here in 59. Igor was here. He loved being in America. And American agents were watching him and thought that he was ready to defect. So they asked Dave Sim whether he would help out in that endeavor. Sim, you know, said, "Of course, I'll do what I can." They befriended one another in Rome, which was not hard. The athletes could very easily mix. As a matter of fact, the Soviet and American track and field teams held a practice session together. The Soviet team came to visit the Americans at their compound in the village. So there was a lot of interaction. Sim and Tarovinesyan went out to dinner one night and were talking about the relative merits of the Western life and the Soviet life. And the plan was that at the second dinner, an American agent would show up and close the deal. As they both described it to me, first Dave Sim, he said, "I didn't know this agent by anything other than the name Mr. Wolf." That's what everybody called him. And Mr. Wolf was supposed to come midway through the dinner and talk to Igor and seal the defection. So then Igor and Sim both described for me what happened that night. Midway through the dinner, Mr. Wolf showed up. He had studied Igor Tarovinesyan very thoroughly, knew that he had grown up in Ukraine, but was in fact an Armenian, that his parents were Soviet Armenians. So Mr. Wolf started talking about Armenia and even talking in the Armenian dialect. And this scared the heck out of Igor Tarovinesyan. He jumped from his chair, thought this guy was a double agent, and said, "Dave Sim, I trust. You, I don't trust." And he stormed out. So that was the end of that defection attempt. The stories of this book come from all of the countries of those tense times. In Germany, the story can be told from both sides of what would be the wall. On the East German side, the star of the Olympics was a 17-year-old diver named Ingrid Kramer, who won both the springboard and platform diving. In typical fashion of that era, the American writers called her the Dresden Doll. It's really fascinating to go back and look at the coverage of women in 1960. I'll talk about that more later. But in terms of Ingrid Kramer and that moniker, all of the women were sort of treated as sex figures, basically. Some of the gymnasts, when they'd write about them, they'd write their measurements in the stories, which I don't think you could do with the young girl gymnasts of today. But then the gymnasts were full-figured, and their measurements were reported in the stories. Sports Illustrated did an entire six-page feature before the Olympics on a Canadian gymnast, only because she was, they thought, beautiful. She finished in about 20th place, but they... And you can read reports from columnists from the New York Times to the San Francisco Chronicle, essentially writing about the women athletes in terms of how what they looked like as opposed to what they performed like. Anyway, so Ingrid Kramer was in that mold as the Dresden Doll. She had grown up in Dresden, Germany. When she was 2 years old, she had gone through the firebombing of that city, which turned the entire city into a firestorm, as Kurt Vonnegut explored in Slaughterhouse-5. Probably a little bit before Ingrid Kramer's real consciousness, but it's so deeply etched in her memory that she told me just 2 years ago that she has had dreams her entire life of an airplane chasing her. and that many of the girls that she grew up with, their hair turned white or gray when they were 5 years old. Ingrid Kramer was one of the stars of the Olympics. She won both of those gold medals. The East Germans treated her as though she were a conquering hero and said that her performance was due primarily or solely to the superiority of the socialist system. She went back to Dresden and to East Germany and was treated well, became a star coach for the Dresden women for years thereafter. Later in the 1960s, the East German women became notorious for the use of testosterone drugs to improve the performance, particularly of the women swimmers, not the divers. It really doesn't help diving, but the swimmers. And it was a horrible, horrible program where many of those girls got very sick when they became older women, and some of them died, and some of them had sex change operations because they were so infused with testosterone, which they were told were merely vitamins. In any case, as part of that, when the reunification of Germany came along, all of the East German coaches were fired, and some of them were put on trial for their administering of those illegal drugs. Ingrid Kramer had nothing to do with that. She, in diving, the drugs weren't used. But when the wall fell, she lost her job, and she fell into a deep depression from which she really has not recovered. And it's one of those interesting sort of unexpected consequences of what is essentially a beneficial act for mankind. For Ingrid Kramer, it was, in one way, the end of her life when that wall fell. On the other side, you had Armin Hari, the German sprinter, who was sort of my favorite rapscallion villain of the book. Armin Hari was called the thief of starts. Everybody thought he cheated from the starting gun. In fact, he probably didn't. They did studies, photographers and videographers of it, and he just had better reactions than any other runner, and he could get off right a couple of hundredths of a second faster than anyone else. But Armin Hari was a jerk. Before the 100-meter dash, Jesse Owens, who was the star of the 1936 games, the one who sort of personally overcame the entire notion of Aryan superiority by winning all those great medals in Nazi Germany, a black American track athlete from Ohio State. In any case, Jesse Owens was in Rome covering the games for a Chicago newspaper. He wanted to speak to Armin Hari, and Hari snubbed him, said, "No, I don't have time for the guy." In one of the great lines of Jesse Owens' life, he said, "I've been snubbed by bigger jerks before, but never by faster ones." In any case, Armin Hari was on the take and on the make. And in one of the first breaches of the code of amateurism, he, in 1960, was taking money from a shoe company. Well, actually, not one shoe company, but two shoe companies. The key shoe companies of that era were both German companies, Adidas and Puma, run by the Dassler brothers. The name Adidas comes from Adi Dassler, who ran Adidas, and Rudi Dassler ran Puma. Well, the brothers both were interested in Armin Hari because he was such a great runner, but they didn't know that each of them were paying him. So that Armin Hari ran the 100-meter dash wearing Adidas shoes, took them off, went on the gold medal stand with Pumas. This was a sign of things to come with Armin Hari. He went on, and as Ingrid Kramer suffered from in her own way, Armin Hari got his just desserts. He became an embezzler later and went to prison. The stories from Africa. In 1960, South Africa, completely apartheid, was still competing in the Olympics. There was a movement just beginning right then to try to change that, led by a man in South Africa named Dennis Brutus. He formed a committee to try to pressure the Olympics to live up to its creed, which is that they don't discriminate by color or race or origin. And he started sending letters to Avery Brundage, the president of the IOC, and to others. For that effort, he was denied a passport to come to Rome, and his office was invaded, and all of his documents were taken. Another official from Great Britain who was supporting him did get to Rome and got a meeting with the IOC to try to present the case. The South African argument in 1960 was that they were trying to integrate their team, but there were no black athletes good enough to make the Olympics. And Avery Brundage and his men bought that argument, at least then. 4 years later, the tumult and change in the world would make it impossible, and finally South Africa was expelled for several decades. But what was going on the other side of Africa, in black Africa, was 14 nations were getting their independence that summer, and no black African had ever won a gold medal. They were just starting to compete. Among the athletes who came to Rome was an Ethiopian runner named Abebe Bikila. Nobody had heard of him outside of Ethiopia. The Ethiopian team had about 11 members. Abebe Bikila came to Rome with a pair of shoes that didn't fit right, so he ditched them. He decided he wouldn't run with shoes. He'd run many times barefoot back in Ethiopia through the hills. So the marathon is about to begin, and it starts at the Capitoline Steps in ancient Rome. And the American marathoners, Gordon McKenzie told me that he and Alan Kelly were standing on the steps, and McKenzie looks over and sees this skin and bones, number 11, in a green shirt, skinny guy without any shoes on. And he turns to Alan Kelly and says, "Well, that's one guy we won't have to worry about." And nobody did until halfway through the race when word came back that the barefoot Ethiopian was in first place, was in the lead. He was so unknown that most of the sports writers called him Bikila Abebe. They had no idea who he was and started to try to find out as the race proceeded. This is one of those incredible symbolic moments that you can't make up, that real life just presents to you. Here is a barefoot Ethiopian running through the streets of Rome. The second half of the race is along the old Appian Way. It's evening. There are Roman sentinels standing along the way holding torchlights as the barefoot Ethiopian comes by. He's running through the streets of the capital city of the nation that had invaded and bombed his homeland only 25 years earlier, Mussolini's army. And Mussolini's army not only had invaded Ethiopia, but they had brought back to Rome one of the great works of antiquity from Ethiopia, the Axum Obelisk, and they placed it in the center of Rome. And here comes Abebe Bikila running past the Axum Obelisk that had been stolen from his homeland. He just takes off, and he wins with a record time for the marathon, running in the darkness in bare feet, ending at the Arch of Constantine, another of the symbols of the country that had defeated his homeland. And as one of his countrymen said, it took an army of a million to defeat Ethiopia and one Ethiopian to defeat Italy. And that was Abebe Bikila in 1960. The whole notion of what was going on in Africa was deeply connected to what was happening in the United States with the civil rights movement. Here you had the United States presenting itself as the beacon of liberty around the world at the same time that millions of its own people, including some of its greatest athletes, were treated as second-class citizens. It's an inarguable fact. The Soviets kept pounding away at that. And what was the answer? So one of the fascinating sort of obvious lessons in retrospect, but hit me over the head as I was reporting the book, is that the Cold War, in that sense, had a beneficial effect on civil rights in the United States. Because of that obvious hypocrisy, it forced the Eisenhower administration, the State Department, the Kennedy administration to act more assertively, not assertively enough, but more so than they might have had it not been that such blatant problem they were having in their foreign policy in Africa and third world countries because of the segregation at home. As in one of the small ways that the United States tried to combat that in Rome was to name Rafer Johnson, a great decathlete, to carry the American flag at the opening ceremonies. Now, Rafer Johnson totally deserved that honor. He was the greatest athlete of that era. And he was not only that, but also a man of tremendous dignity. He was the captain of the team. All of his teammates on the U.S. squad respected him. He deserved the honor. But it was also he also knew that he was being manipulated to some extent, that he was being used by the powers that be to try to present a different face to the world. And that's a conundrum that blacks in the United States have often faced about the expectations of the people in power of how they should behave and how they can be used. But blacks, what choices do they have? So Rayford Johnson faced it, knew the hypocrisy of it, but said to himself, the way that I can improve civil rights, what I can do is to first win the gold medal, be the best athlete I can be, and second, to comport myself with dignity and pride and show the world who I am. And so he agreed to carry the American flag. He also won the gold medal. And that was another one of the most thrilling moments of these Olympics. Some of the sports writers kind of have always had fun making fun of the decathlon as a, sort of an effort in mediocrity. Because in truth, there are 10 events over 2 days, and the athletes who perform in those are not at the top world class in any single event, or maybe one, but rarely more than that. But nonetheless, it requires such incredible durability and dexterity. And Rayford Johnson was the best in the world, along with C.K. Young from Taiwan or Formosa, which we talked about earlier. And in fact, because of the International Olympics Committee's decision to force Taiwan to call itself by that name, or Formosa, but not the Republic of China, which is how they like to be called, there was a backlash against that decision. Avery Brundage, the same man who was a conservative, arch-conservative Republican from Chicago, was suddenly being called a communist sympathizer because the Olympic Committee had said Taiwan is Taiwan, not China. There was an effort to boycott the Olympics. The State Department was pushing Taiwan to boycott the Olympics rather than accede to that nomenclature. The reason they didn't is because they had this great athlete, C.K. Young, who they knew would win a medal. He was a teammate of Rayford Johnson's at UCLA. They trained together. They were very close friends. And they were almost equal as decathletes. Rafer was better at the javelin throw, the shot put, the discus. C.K. was better at some of the sprints in the pole vault. And it all came down to the final event, the metric mile, the 1,500-meter race, on the second night in the evening. Not only were they teammates, but they had the same coach, Ducky Drake, the UCLA coach, was there in the stadium in the front row. And C.K. Young was a better miler. His best time was 13 seconds better than Rayford Johnson's best time. Rayford Johnson had to win by 10 seconds or less, and he would get the gold medal because he was in front going into that race. So before the race starts, Rayford Johnson walks over to his coach, Ducky Drake, and he said, Ducky, what should I do? C.K.'s a better miler than I am. How would you suggest I run this race? And Ducky said, well, look, C.K. is a better miler than you, but you just have to stick with him. And when it comes to the bell lap, C.K. is going to turn around, and you have to be there. And he's going to try to take off, and you have to stay with him, and you can break his will psychologically. So Rayford Johnson comes back. C.K. Young walks over to Ducky Drake. Ducky, how can I win this race? What do you suggest? Well, Rayford's a better miler than you are. But when it comes to the last lap, he's going to try to be at your side, and you just got to take off and break his will. He was like a chess player playing both sides. So the race begins, and Rayford Johnson had one advantage. He knew he was retiring after this race. The decathlon is the most exhausting enterprise you can imagine. 5 events each day for 2 days. And this was the last, and ending with the mile, which is a brutal race. This was the last time that Rafer would ever have to do it. And that's what he kept telling himself as the race progressed. I hate this damn race. I never have to do it again. Just keep in there, keep running, hang in there. I'll never have to do it again. So they get to the last lap. Just as Ducky Drake predicted, C.K. turned around looked over his shoulder, and there's Rafer right at his side, right behind him, smiling. Rafer said to me, I was smiling out of pain, and I was acting, but I knew that I had to be there, and I had to smile. And it worked. It did break CK's will. He tried to accelerate. He couldn't get away from Rafer. Rafer finished close enough behind CK, just a few feet behind, that he won the gold medal. And as they crossed the finish line, they collapsed into each other's arms. Now, the whole Olympic ideal of athletes competing to the best of the ability and having nothing to do with the politics of the world is completely bogus. But there are, in every Olympics, these wonderful moments, and that was one of them. The black athlete from the United States and the Asian from Taiwan, really close friends, collapsing in each other's arms. And the photographs of that moment are authentic statements of sportsmanship. And Rafer told me later that as great as he felt and relieved as he felt about winning that race, he felt almost as bad that CK had to lose. The story of the Olympics that really drew me in the deepest had to do with Wilma Rudolph and the Tiger Bells of Tennessee State University. Wilma Rudolph became a star in those Olympics. She won 3 gold medals. These were the first televised Olympics, so the whole world saw her. We didn't see her live. There was no live coverage yet. The satellites weren't up for transatlantic communications yet. As a matter of fact, the video and film was literally put in canisters in the belly of commercial jets and flown back to New York. And sometimes shown that night if an event happened early enough in the morning because of the time difference, usually shown the next day. Jim McKay, who I talked about earlier, was the host of those games. He wasn't even in Rome. He was back in New York City at a studio in Grand Central Station. The film would come in. He'd be sitting there at his typewriter, pounding out a script as it was being edited, looking at the Encyclopedia Britannica to find out where a country was. But it was televised, which was not what happened in Melbourne in 1956. And here came Wilma Rudolph, this beautiful, lithe runner with a charismatic personality, and she stole the show. She had both a grace about her and a story that were incredible. She was one of 22 children from a family from Clarksville, Tennessee. She'd probably had childhood polio. That's what all the reports say. I couldn't find the records at the Meharry Medical Center where she was treated, but it appears that she had polio. She certainly had scarlet fever. In any case, one of her legs had been slightly withered and out of joint, and she wore braces for 3 years. She went to Melbourne in 1956 as a 16-year-old, barely 16, won a bronze medal there, came back to high school in Clarksville, and got pregnant. So that by the time she got to Rome, she'd overcome polio and teenage pregnancy and won 3 gold medals and led the Tiger Bells to the incredible moments of the Olympics. And as amazing as her story is, the Tiger Bell story really resonates even deeper with me. The Tiger Bells were the women's track team at Tennessee State University in Nashville, Tennessee, an historically black college. This was long before Title IX. There were no scholarships for women athletes then. There were very few programs for women, particularly in track and field. There was no distance beyond 880 meters that they were allowed to run. It was considered unladylike. The marathon didn't come to women until 1984. In that situation that the Tiger Bells lived and worked. Furthermore, there were black women in the Jim Crow South in 1960. Their coach, Ed Temple, didn't even have an office at Tennessee State. He had to share his office with his wife, who was the postmaster of the little school. He had nothing to offer the women except his training. They didn't even have a bus to travel to different meets. They'd take a clunky old station wagon and couldn't stop for meals, so they'd pack peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. afraid to stop at service stations to go to the bathroom. They'd say it's time to hit the fields when they had to go, and they'd pull over to the side of the road. They came out of that nothingness to create the greatest women's track and field team in history, and really paved the way for so many women athletes to follow. And there was one last moment involving Wilma Rudolph that I'll end with. It was after she won the gold medal. She came back to Nashville. And her hometown of Clarksville wanted to hold a parade for her. Everybody loved Wilma Rudolph. I haven't even mentioned yet Cassius Clay, who was the white heavyweight champion. And the reason is on purpose. He wasn't a major figure in these Olympics. He became the most famous athlete in the world four years later. But in 1960, he was just an obstreperous little brother driving everybody else on the team crazy with his boasting. He had the same personality in 1960 that he would have later, but none of the meaning behind it. He was afraid to fly. They had to give him sleeping pills to get him on the plane over to Rome. They didn't put him to sleep. He yapped all his way over there. He met everyone in the village, but there was one person he really wanted to meet, and that was Wilma Rudolph. He was head over heels for her, as was everybody, as were the town fathers of Clarksville because of what she had done, winning these gold medals. So they said they wanted to hold a parade and banquet for her when she got back to Clarksville. And she said, no, you can't do it unless the parade and the banquet are integrated. And they acceded to that request. They had really no choice. And her guts to say that brought about the first time in Clarksville history that black and white officials and black and white families sat together in the armory of Clarksville to honor Wilma Rudolph. Thank you very much. And I'd be happy to take questions on this book or any book. I think you're supposed to get the microphone there.
Thank you very much. And it is a brilliant book, and we appreciate your insights. One question from more of the political world of 1960. Did you have a chance to meet with Mr. Andreotti, who you mentioned twice in the book, to get his perspective on the Italians hosting it in light of him still being alive today?
Mr. Andreotti, who was the defense minister of Italy and the president of the Italian Olympic Committee, was still alive when I went to Rome. We had a meeting set up with him, but an emergency happened, so I didn't get to talk to him. But I did spend 3 weeks in Rome and interviewed several of the athletes, including Livio Beruti, another star who won the 200-meter dash and also was in love with Wilma Rudolph, and told me that if only he could have gotten alone with her, he could have consummated their platonic relationship. And many of the great Italian sports writers who were just starting off then, and several other officials. So I got a good sense of the Italian perspective and try to present that in the book. There was one moment during my research in Rome that I'll never forget. This was only 15 years after World War II. So the Rome Olympics, in a sense, were really Italy's coming out from under the shadows of the Mussolini regime and the fascist era. The area where most of the Olympics were held, where the Stadio Olimpico was, had been, much of it had been built by Mussolini, and it had been called the Foro Mussolini until they changed it to the Foro Italico. But etched into the sidewalks as you walked to the stadium were still all of these signs honoring Il Duce. It was everywhere. This was only 15 years earlier. It's like today going back to the early Clinton administration. It's not that long ago. For America, World War II by 1960 seemed ancient because America was forgetting and trying to move forward and was, you know, in that just look forward mode. Some of the athletes hadn't even been born when these Olympics, when the World War II ended. Donna DiVerona, the swimmer, was only 13. She was born after World War II. But in Italy and in Europe, World War II was still very much on their minds, and these Olympics had something to do with that. And so we came to Rome, and we went into the assembly hall where Andreotti and his men would meet every morning before the Olympics began. On the two sides of this assembly hall were these, in 1960, they were covered up by green felt. When we got there, only a couple of years earlier, the felt had been taken down. And what was behind it were these incredible, frightening murals that were called the Apotheosis of Fascism, with Mussolini in the center, surrounded by the black shirts, and all of these symbols of the fascist era. So it was still there in 1960. Yes, sir.
Forget, what was her afterlife?
Thanks for asking. Wilma Rudolph married the father of her first child, Yolanda, who lived with her sister and then her parents for a little while and then came to live with Wilma. She became a coach and an inspirational speaker and died at an early age, at 52, of a brain tumor. And when I was interviewing her coach, Ed Temple, we spent several hours in this little restaurant in North Nashville called Sweat's Barbecue, very close to the Tennessee State campus. And Ed Temple was describing for me how it was right there at Sweat's, right over in that corner over there, where he spent his last hours with Wilma Rudolph. And they'd walked around the Tennessee State track, which was two-thirds of a track and full of cleat marks because the football team had practiced there. And they'd talked about their lives. And then they came over to Sweat's, and Mr. Sweat had carried her tray over to that table. You know, she would die 3 days later. And that was his last memories of Wilma Rudolph. Yes.
I remember hearing about Avery Brundage for quite a long period of time. How powerful was he, and why did he stay that way for so long? And could you talk about some of the colorful aspects of his life?
It's all thank in you. My book, and thank you for asking. This book weaves so many things together that I can never put them all in 25-minute speech. But Avery Brundage is often one I talk about. For those of you who don't know him, he was a decathlete himself at the University of Illinois in the 1912 Olympics, the ones won by Jim Thorpe. Brundage had been responsible or part of the movement later to remove Jim Thorpe's medals because he'd been a semi-pro baseball player later. Brundage was a hypocrite and an anti-Semite and a man who believed that the Olympic movement was bigger than any ideology or religion. Sometimes that would have him make decisions that perhaps were right, often wrong. But the decision that, in my mind, etches him forever was in 1936, when he was the president of the American Olympic Committee. And as I was researching Avery Brundage at the archive at the University of Illinois, I came across all these letters that he was exchanging with German officials as those Olympics were approaching. And he was writing about how it was a cabal of a Jewish conspiracy to try to boycott those Olympics, and that he would appreciate it if the German officials would send to him the clippings showing what the real good things that the Nazis were doing, because the American press was portraying them as evil people, and that couldn't be the case. So he prevailed. There was no boycott. Boycotts are always debatable no matter what's going on. And in 1936, it's a fascinating debate because the Americans went over there, led by Jesse Owens, who won all those medals. And so it had a fascinating effect to have had allowed those Olympics to go on. It certainly didn't change anything with Nazi Germany, with World War II and the horrors of the Holocaust still to come. When Avery Brundage came back from Germany in 1936 after the Olympics, He took part in a rally at Madison Square Garden, attended by 19,000 German Americans, a German American Bund. And at that rally, he walked up and gave a speech extolling the virtues of Hitler and the Nazis and saying that America had much to learn from them. That was Avery Brundage in 1936. Avery Brundage went on to become the head of the International Olympic Committee. He was very astute politically. Everybody sort of hated him, but he always knew how to survive, and he survived longer as the head of the Olympic Committee than anyone else. The athletes in particular hated him. They called him Slavery Avery. And in part it was because of the draconian rules of amateurism in that era. Like so many other parts of sports, it begins with the athletes being completely used and abused, and then it proceeds from there to them getting their freedom and then people thinking that it's excessive when they all become multimillionaires and spoiled brats. But it starts with the abuse, and Slavery Avery was part of that. He thought of himself as a king. He was in the Olympic movement when he was leading it. The executive committee of the International Olympic Committee were all of these lords and dukes and princes. Avery Brundage himself was not one. He was a self-made millionaire businessman from Chicago, but he liked to behave like a lord. The vice president of the IOC during that era was the Marquess of Exeter from Great Britain, who many of you will recognize as a character in the movie Chariots of Fire. He was the hurdler, the upper-class hurdler who set up champagne glasses on each of the hurdles outside of his manse and would practice running over the hurdles so that the champagne bottles glasses wouldn't drop. Anyway, the Marquess was the vice president. But it was easy for people like that to uphold this sort of 19th century notion of amateurism. They're so rich, of course you compete and don't worry about money. But most athletes come out of poverty and hunger, and it's a far different situation for them. And you had these preposterous examples of the application of pure amateurism where, for instance, Lee Calhoun, a great hurdler of that era, who had won the gold medal in 1956 in Melbourne and would win it again in Rome in 1960, was suspended for a year in between because he and his college sweetheart, Gwen, got married on the TV show Bride and Groom. And he was said to be a professional because they took some presents, some wedding presents on that television show, and he never would have been on the show unless he were a famous hurdler. Of course, no one else on that show had ever been a famous hurdler or even an athlete. In any case, it was that kind of imposition of quote unquote amateurism that led to the reaction to it. And Brundage was always trying to sort of hold the walls, for better or worse, often for worse, sometimes for better. You know, he's trying to hold back the coming of the modern era, and he survived for a long time. He would give all these moralistic speeches about self-responsibility. At the same time, he was one of the great philanderers of all time. He had thousands of paramours and a mistress who... He had a whole separate family unbeknownst to anybody until Sports Illustrated uncovered it in the 1970s. So he was a really fascinating man. Sometimes he would make the right decision, like on Taiwan and mainland China. I try to give him his humanity in this book. It's not easy. Yes. Wait a second.
Thanks. I'm really impressed with the way you think about culture and politics as well as sports. And I'm wondering, given the current state of the Olympics in China and the incredible repression by the Chinese government against Tibet, the Tibetan people, and their own people over the years, as they have one of the worst records of abuse of their own civilians in the world. How do you see these Olympic Games coming up now?
These games will be as political as any games. They always are. They always operate on two tracks. One is the athletic events and one is the politics. It's one of the rare times when the entire world is in one place at the same time. And so it's inevitable. There will be some amazing performances, I'm sure, in Beijing. You know, just the story so far of Dara Torres, the 41-year-old swimmer, is amazing. And I'm sure there'll be, you know, Phelps will win 7 or 8 gold medals, and there'll be all kinds of stories about the events, and they'll be very noteworthy and terrific stories. But I think for history, what will be remembered is how China handles these Olympics. It will be the Chinese introduction into the 20th century, which they think will be their century, for better or worse. And you're right. They have, you know, human rights, pollution, Tibet, the thousands of journalists from around the world who will be there poking around and trying to, in a nation that is accustomed to complete control. I don't know how it's going to go, but I know that that's how it will be remembered, for better or worse. And history will call these the Chinese Olympics. It won't be remembered for the athletes.
So I didn't want to steer the conversation to my own agenda, but I read your book about marching into sunlight, because I was in Wisconsin during the riots. Oh. And I don't know, you probably run into people all the time. So I just, that's one of the reasons I came down here, is just to meet you and see you. Yeah. Could you say anything about the way this immersion, your journalism, you're kind of sort of wading into these parts of history and immersing yourself in it, in this very intimate, in-depth, personal way with individuals that were also immersed in it. And I wonder how that affects you. And, you know, I find it very sort of awe-inspiring that you do that, and you're kind of a witness that brings these stories back to the world. But if you could say a few words, sure, about how that works for you. And
yeah. Well, the book that you're mentioning, They Marched Into Sunlight, I know I'll never not write another book like that again. It was the most psychologically rewarding and depleting and difficult book I could undertake. I'm from Madison, Wisconsin. For those of you who don't know, this book takes place in October of 1967, and it's about the war and the anti-war, which were two very different worlds about the same thing. So half the book is the first riot on a college campus where the police came in and bashed the heads of students, a protest against Dow Chemical Company, the makers of napalm. At the same time, in Vietnam, a battalion from the 1st Infantry Division was walking out on a search-and-destroy mission and got destroyed, with 60 men killed and 60 wounded out of 140 in the battalion. And so I brought these two worlds together and interwove them in the book. And I moved to Madison for part of the book, where I'm from. I hadn't been living there in 32 years. And some of the subjects from that part of the story were still in Madison. And I found others from around the country and a lot of the archival documents, and tried to recreate a moment that I knew pretty well, because I was a freshman at Wisconsin that October, although I wasn't I was on the outside of the riots, wearing my first blue jean jacket, and sort of was affected, as many freshmen were, by what they saw that day, affected forever. The Vietnam side of the story I knew nothing about until I started this book. I had never been to Vietnam. I was not a Vietnam veteran. That part of the book will live with me more deeply than anything I've ever done, because I became a witness for all of these soldiers who'd endured the worst that man can do to man. And they felt that the government had lied about that battle, and that the general was given a Silver Star who wasn't even there. There were so many different aspects to it that, and they were caught in a horrible ambush, surrounded on three sides, outnumbered 9-1. They all thought they would die. So in every possible respect, that day is so deeply etched in their memories that it defines them to now. And so dealing with those men and winning their trust and then having to present them to the world was very difficult, but, as I said, incredibly rewarding. And that's what I try to do. You know, just find, you know, this, with this book, I thought that Rafer Johnson and Wilma Rudolph and the coach Ed Temple had been overshadowed in history by people like Muhammad Ali. And I wanted them to get their due. And so that's why I spent so much time with people like that. Thank you. Hold on a sec.
I just wanted to know what Rafer Johnson is doing now.
Rafer Johnson is 72 years old. He looks like he could win the decathlon in Beijing. He's in incredible shape. He was part of the Kennedy entourage after that for a large part of his life. He went into acting, was sort of a B-list actor in several movies. He was deeply involved in the Special Olympics, and that's still what he's doing. My first interview with him was at the office of the Special Olympics in Los Angeles. For those of you who don't know this story, he was so close to the Kennedys that he was in the kitchen of the Ambassador Hotel the night that Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. And if you listen to the audio tapes, you can hear someone yelling, "Get the gun, Rafer, get the gun." And it was Rafer Johnson and the football player Rosie Grier who tackled Sirhan Sirhan and took the gun away from him. And something that's really hard to believe that it happened, but it did, Rafer put the gun in his sport coat and forgot that he had it. And for some reason, the cops didn't sort of keep everybody in there until they found the gun. So he went home with the gun in his pocket and found it a couple of days later and drove over to the police station and turned it in. Yes, ma'am.
I've always been curious of how professional basketball got into the Olympics. It seems as though they're doing it backwards.
Professional basketball.
Yeah.
Thanks for asking that question. Another story that I didn't get to tonight involved what I consider to be the real dream team, which was the 1960 basketball team, where the backcourt was Oscar Robertson and Jerry West. I don't think there's ever been a better backcourt in history. They were both college players, Oscar Robertson from the University of Cincinnati, coming out of Crispus Attucks High School in Indianapolis, and Jerry West from the University of West Virginia, coming out of a small town, Cabin Creek in West Virginia. And they were the co-captains of the team. That team had four future Hall of Famers, those two plus Walt Bellamy and Jerry Lucas. And they were all college kids. And they won every game by an average of 30 points. But the world was catching up, and the world was changing. And as many sports became, the walls of amateurism and professionalism merged in many sports in the Olympics, and basketball was one of those. And the United States decided that after they'd lost a couple of times that they couldn't stand that anymore. So they started bringing in the professionals, and that brought the 1992 Dream Team of Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson and Larry Bird, then the team we have going to Beijing, led by Kobe Bryant and LeBron James. And the great irony is that even the professionals don't always win now. You know, they didn't win in 4 years ago, and they might not win in Beijing. But it's just a fact of life today. I mean, the Olympics are completely commercialized. this is not the United States basketball team that you're rooting for. It's the Nike team that you're rooting for. You know, they're wearing Nike shoes. They're wearing Nike uniforms. Last week, they all gathered in New York at a, you know, event sponsored by Nike. And that's what it is. That's the way it works today. One more. Okay.
The starting blocks and they had to go back and look at tapes to figure out did he start on time or did he jump the gun. I read something in the paper about the swimming. They were still using stopwatches back then. You talked about the, I forget her name, the woman who ran the marathon barefoot. My question is about sort of a technology theme that runs through the Olympics and sort of what was going on in 1968, both the way reporters filed their reports, the way athletes trained or didn't train, and then the equipment that they used.
Yeah, this was right at the cusp of change. And, you know, that fits into the whole theme of the book, that you could see the modern world emerging at that point, but it was still the old world in many respects, you know, from the archaic nature of the television to the swimming, the way swimming was judged in that era. It was before electronic touchpads. There were three judges leaning over the finish line of each swimmer who had stopwatches. And then there were judges on the sides of the pool on these bleachers. For the event that I write about in the book, it was the 100-meter freestyle, the American Lance Larson against the Australian John Devitt, finishing very close together. The stopwatch judges all had Devitt with a time that was 2/10 of a second faster, 2/100 of a second faster. The judges on the side said it was a tie, and there's this old official judge who's way in the background somewhere, and he declares that Devitt, the Australian, is the winner. And to make that, you know, he had the authority to do it. To make that possible, they had to change the times for Lance Larson because he couldn't have a faster time and lose, and that's the way it was in that era. So, you know, I mean, in so many ways, everything was just changing then. The next Olympics, they did have the touchpads, and for better and worse, everything was changing. Thank you very much.
Please join us upstairs in the lobby for the book signing.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.